He's a fire captain, and he went through one of the most heartbreaking, traumatic experiences that one could possibly imagine. He's here to tell his story on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. Welcome to the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. In the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show, we are joined by special guests talking about their experiences, the realities of investigating crimes, plus those who have experienced horrendous trauma. Police, first responders, military, and victims of crime share their stories. Hi, I'm John J. Wiley. In addition to being a broadcaster, I'm also a retired police sergeant. Be sure to check out our website, letradio.com, and also like us on Facebook. Search for the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. Of all the radio stations in the United States, there are no other shows like the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. And on Facebook, there's only one official page. Do a search on Facebook for the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. And be sure to like the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show Facebook page. Connecting with us from California, we have a fire captain, Ed Monroe, on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and podcast. Ed, first of all, thank you for your service, and thanks for being a guest on this show. Talk about something that's very difficult. I appreciate it very much.
First, I want to thank you for having me, especially on Law Enforcement Talk Radio, because being a guy from the other side of the street, so to speak, being a fire captain, it's not lost on me what you guys do and how tough that is.
Well, that's one of the things that people need to know, is that we are a family. We call a family of blue and red. We may tease each other. We may kid each other, but we got each other's backs all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
And that, without fail, in Baltimore, the firefighters, one of the things that people need to understand, and I don't think they do, is that on every call, almost every call, a firefighter was injured. It may be severe, it may not be severe, and way too many were killed. And by the way, there's no break for the firefighters. There's no break for the EMTs in particular, because they go call to call to call. That's nothing but bad stuff happening and lots of trauma that just never ends.
We definitely see a lot of stuff that the normal person out in the world doesn't realize we see.
And it has an impact on you, your families. And before we get into your story, because I got to tell you, this is one of the most compelling stories I've ever heard. And I only know a little bit about it. Ed will tell the story. It involves a firefighter being killed, another firefighter involved in it, murder. It's unbelievable stuff, but it did happen. One of the things that people don't really appreciate, I believe, is how all this trauma affects the individual on the job, most importantly, away from the job. For me, on the job, I knew what to do. It's when things got quiet that problems came in, and it really had a big impact on my marriage, my children as well. Would that be safe to say for you?
Well, it's absolutely safe to say to me. And in my case, even though I've had this big sideways critical incident, it is absolutely safe to say that the majority of the people in this line of work, whether it's law enforcement or fire, it's just a cumulative trauma, the stuff you see every day. It's the stuff we tell ourselves is normal, but is 100% not normal. The human brain is not set up to process all the stuff we see on a day-in, day-out basis.
Yeah, I could tell you story, and you could match story for story. And one of the things that you just said is these are not normal. Like when we go to a barbecue, people would ask me things like, tell us about this. And I don't want to talk about it because it is that. If I do talk about it, it's going to be in police terms the way we talk. Dark humor is often involved because that's one of the things we use to deal with the trauma as well as we can. But it is not natural. It's not normal. And yet our firefighters, our EMTs, our police, our law enforcement officers, other first responders see it every day.
You're right. And, I always say if people heard how we talk about it in the fire engine or at the firehouse, and I'm sure how you would talk about it at the station or how we would do it at the cookouts, so many people would just be shocked about how we talk about it. But you're right. It's how we diffuse it, and it's how we try to de-escalate all the emotions from it from seeing it.
And in the
short term, that's effective, but in the long term, I'm not sure that that's very effective at all.
I don't think it is. And one of the things I got to ask you before we get into your story, back in the day, and I love saying this because it makes it sound like I'm really, really old, by the way, I'm a lot older than I ever thought I'd be. Back in the day, we had terminology. It was the phrase was, "You're Baltimore police. Suck it up, Buttercup. You can do your job. We have a job to do. You can lick your wounds later." And the way we dealt with things before they call them critical incidents is, you got a case of beer and you went to a parking lot and you kind of hashed it out. That's the way it talked. That seemed to work. However, like my case and many other people's cases, the alcohol became an issue.
Oh, yeah, and it's an issue. It's an issue for fire. I know it's an issue for law enforcement. It's an issue for anybody that does this. You look for ways to cope and to numb yourself from what you've seen and what you've felt. And whether it's alcohol or another substance, you're just self-medicating. You're just trying to make it all go away, but it doesn't go away. The ghosts still follow you, so to speak, for lack of a better way to paint the picture.
Right. Now, you're newer in a career than I was. When did you start?
I was hired in 2008.
All right. So that's when we had the critical incidents, which, by the way, the big stuff, the really traumatic stuff, they qualify as critical incidents. Before that, the 1980s, in our department at least, we didn't have critical incidents. It was everyday policing. That's just the way things were. And as an industry, I think we've gotten a lot better at dealing with the critical incidents, the really big things, the Sandy Hooks, the Uvaldes. By the way, they're not even going to start on that conversation. But those things we get a lot better at dealing with. It's the everyday grind that we tend to ignore.
Yep. And it's the everyday grind that causes people doing what we do to have problems at work, problems at home, problems with themselves. It makes them turn to substance abuse. It makes them turn to suicide. It makes them turn to all this reckless stuff because they feel like they're alone and nobody understands.
Right, right. And eventually, they say, and this is one of the things I'm going to phrase it as a question. Well, is it true that police won't talk to each other because of a machismo thing? And I was like, that's not really accurate in my experience. It's because I don't want to talk about it with anybody.
Yeah, I would say that's true for most guys. Talking is hard. And now you didn't see this back in the day. You know, back when you were on the force, you didn't see peer support organizations and you didn't see access to you know, clinically competent and culturally competent therapists. That kind of stuff was really hard to find.
Yeah.
And now you see an effort. We're doing better at it, but it's still, I think we have a long way to go. That's
now,
my opinion.
By the way, Ed Monroe, you're an active duty. Is it fire captain?
Yes.
All right. And I'm not familiar intimately with the different ranks in the different departments. In Baltimore, you had firefighters, you had lieutenants, then you had captains, and then they had the command staff. Is it the same where you are?
Yeah, so I work for Los Angeles County Fire Department, and we're a really large department. We have over 3,000 badge personnel. And we have firefighters and firefighter paramedics. So it's basically the same rank. We have engineers, which would be like your lieutenants. And then we have fire captains, which is where I'm at. And then after that, my supervisor, he's a battalion chief. So that's how that works.
So you're pretty high up there. You're kind of a, what they call a muckety muck.
Oh, my goodness. Please don't. I am definitely not a muckety muck. I'm just a guy at the fire station who rides Big Red.
There we go. We're talking with Ed Monroe. He's a fire captain in California. And when we return on Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show, we're going to talk about a really, truly horrendous incident that he went through. Its impacts on him, how it impacted his family, and how he rebuilt his life after. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Get access to free podcast versions of the show and more on Facebook. Do a search for the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and be sure to click like. Return a conversation with Ed Monroe, fire captain for a big department in law. He said it earlier, Los Angeles County Fire Department. And he was involved in a truly horrendous incident. The term we use nowadays is critical incident. Ed, I appreciate you talking about this because number one, it's bad enough going through it. and I feel horrible for the family members involved, but I feel equally as bad for those who survived and had to handle it. I always say this all the time. God bless our first responders. We talk about when people are killed or die in horrible accidents, all those things are horrible. We say, I give prayers to the family. Well, I also give prayers for those who handled it because they bear an extra burden that a lot of people are not aware of.
Absolutely. And I talk about this for two reasons. One, I want to honor those my brothers who died and bring honor to their families. And second, knowing what I went through and the dark pit that I fell into trying to get through this, I know how alone I felt. And if I can reach even one person out there and tell them, hey, man, I've been there. You're not alone. And when I realized I wasn't alone, it helped me a lot. So that's why I talk about this.
And there's some light at the end of the tunnel. What caused the trauma doesn't go away. But you can build a life afterwards. And I'm proof of that, and as so are you. So tell us about the incident. What happened?
So for me, and this is my story, I'm not going to pretend to be able to tell their story. For me, what happened was I was at my fire station that day. I had been a captain for about 2.5 years, and I thought I was ready to face whatever came down the road because you've been trained and you have all this experience. And for me, the phone rang. And we never get significant calls because the phone rings, but the phone rings and I answer the phone. I'm like, hi, Captain Monroe, fire station 132. And it's a paramedic from the next station up the road. And he's like, Monroe, because I'm not messing around, except you use a different word. And he goes, came in here. He shot and killed Tori. He shot Arnie and I need help. And I'm sitting there on the phone and I didn't know what to do. Because nobody's ever called me with anything like that, much less one of my own guys. And I said, all right, copy that. Help's on its way. And hung up the phone. And my guys are coming to the office. And we all tried to make phone calls to dispatch and to the chiefs. And we couldn't get a hold of anybody. And finally got a hold of somebody at dispatch. And they're like, yeah, we have a call. We have people en route. I'm like, copy that. And we got off the phone and I'm like, hey man, I look at my crew and I told them, I said, hey, I used to work with this guy who did the shooting. And I'm trying not to use his name too much. But we used to work together at this fire station. If he's on some kind of rampage, he could be coming here. So let's get out to the rig. We'll put our body armor on and we'll go from there. And that's what we did. And then, we're out there putting that stuff on. We decided that we were going to go post up in the parking lot down at the grocery store because we didn't want to be sitting in the fire station. So we left, and before we even got down the road half a mile, and this is only like 2 minutes after the phone call, my dispatch hits me up and said, hey, we need another fire engine to head up towards fire station 81 where this happened. I'm like, all right, copy that. Well, Eric, flip it around. He's my engineer. And so we're going to 81s. So we're heading there. I texted my wife on the way. I said, hey, you're going to hear some stuff on the news. I'm okay. I'll talk to you later. We made a plan about what to do if we saw him coming this way, the guy who did the shooting. And we were going to crash the rig into him just because we didn't want anybody else to get hurt. We don't have any other way to stop him, but if we saw him, we were going to do the best we could. And I don't know if that was a great plan or not, but it's where our head was at. We didn't see him.
Well, we kept heading up there. Before you go further than that, you didn't get training on what to do in that situation.
No, we're so the firemen.
Like you're firefighters, and you're like, we put out fires. We don't know how to deal with this. This is what I'm getting at, Ed, is you and I both know this. We can train for every imaginable situation there is, and something will pop up that no one ever predicted, and this sounds like that.
We didn't know what to do. The guy who did the shooting, he and I were friends, and we had worked together at one point for a year. He'd been to my in-law's house, and I knew him quite well. I had no idea this was going to happen the day it happened. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. The guy he killed, I've known him for as long as I've been on the job. I love that guy. He was my hero. When I got hired, I looked up to him. I wanted to be him. And then the other guy who got shot, he and I had worked together off and on for a bunch of years. And he was still alive. He's still alive today, but he'll never work again because of his wounds. So, I mean, all three of these guys were guys I was really close to. I had no idea what to do, but, you know, our plan was not to let him hurt anybody else if we saw him.
That's a good plan. And one of the things that I used to do is you knew certain procedures of what you had to do. And I'm sure it's the same with firefighters. When you're on your way to a call, there's not a lot of thinking. It's really reverting to your training. So I do X, Y, and Z, this, and this. Certain calls, one, for example, was when I was a rookie, was a man who set himself on fire with gasoline and got a call for. And I'm thinking to myself, what do I do? I have no idea what to do. No one ever taught me this. No one ever taught me how to handle afterwards. And unfortunately, and I was praying in the way the call that it was unfounded. It was not. It was for real. And his family's right there. What do you tell him? What do you do?
You don't know what to do. And there is not a day in the fire academy where they tell you, all right, this is what you do when one of your guys goes off the deep end and starts shooting the rest of you. There is not that day at the fire academy. Because you know how it is on the job. They tell you, trust your equipment, trust your training, trust your experience. And, there was not a slide in the carousel for this.
So here you are, you're on the way, and you tell your guy, if we see them, let's just run them over. Let's hit them with the rake.
Yeah, that was our plan.
And hopefully you didn't see him, right?
No, we didn't see him. We knew what kind of car he drove. We did not see him. We made it all the way to the fire station, which there's a lot of wildland interface there, which for you East Coasters means a bunch of open area where there's brush fires.
Right.
10 miles from my station to that station, even though it's the next station. So I'm heading that way. We don't see him. We get there. One of our helicopters is down there in front of that fire station. They happen to be doing shift change at that time. They got there really fast. And they're going to airlift out the other captain who had been shot. So I told my engineer to pull up on the side of the road, wait for the helicopter to clear, and then we'll pull in and we'll go to work. And that's what we did. I saw them load Arnie up. They took off. We pulled up and told my guys, hey, get your gear. I need you to go all the way around the building looking for other victims. I'm going to go tie in with the other captain.
We're going to take a short break on that note. We're talking with Ed Monroe, fire captain. By the way, you can get more information about his speaking conferences and events he does at brothershelpingbrothers.org. Just go there, do a search for Ed Monroe. And we'll give you his email address in a little bit. If you want to be a guest on the Law Enforcement Talk radio show, simply contact us. It couldn't be easier. You can send us a message on Facebook. Look for and like the Law Enforcement Talk radio show page or email jay@letradio.com. That's jay@letradio.com. We'll return to our conversation on Law Enforcement Talk radio show. We're going to talk more about what happened that day and then most importantly, what happened after and what he did with that to get to where he is today. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Follow the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and podcast on the Newsbreak app. It's free. And get the latest crime and law enforcement news on the Newsbreak app. It's simple, easy, and free. Just download the Newsbreak app. Then search for and follow the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and podcast on the Newsbreak app. Return our conversation with Ed Monroe on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. Ed is a fire captain in Los Angeles County Fire Department in California. Get more information about what he does at brothershelpingbrothers.org. Just do a search for Ed Monroe, and he'll be speaking at one of their big events coming up. Ed, before we went to break, we talked about you got to this call. And by the way, a quick rehash. A firefighter you knew came in a department, a station, shot and killed another firefighter, and then shot and severely injured another one who I believe is a fire captain. And before we went to break, you arrived at the scene, and you're loading people up into stretchers and ambulances. Was there anything that could prepare you for what you encountered?
Well, we didn't load anybody, to be honest. We watched the captain get loaded onto a helicopter. He took off. The copter took off. My guys went to work looking for any other possible victims, and I went to go tie in with the captain that was on scene running the call at that point because we were the second fire engine there. So I went to go tie in with the first fire engine that was there. When I got up to Jeff, that's the other captain, I asked him, hey, man, what do you need? And he's like, I think we're good. I'm like, are you sure? He's like, yeah. And he's pacing. I'm like, Jeff, where's Tori? And he pointed to our apparatus bay, which is, you know, where they parked the fire engine. And I can see him down on the ground in the doorway. And I went up to him. I walked up there, and Jeff walked with me. And they've got, like, this dirty blanket on him. And I can see his fluids coming out. And this is my good friend of 13 years. And he's there on the ground. And I look at Jeff, and I'm like, hey, we need to get a flag. And he's like, you're right. And so I ended up taking down the flag that was flying on the flagpole at the fire station, and we used that. And that was the last flag to fly over that station that day. And we draped Tori with it, and I posted up next to him. And I'm looking down, and I see the shell casings next to me. And I can tell you how they were sitting to this day. I could go there. I could draw a map of it if I had to. And how I started thinking how the floor was hard and it was cold and he was had to be feeling like he was alone.
Right.
And now I couldn't leave him because I didn't ever want to look at his family and say, I just left him here. And so I stood there doing my best stoic guard routine and I'm watching guys break down and they're sobbing. And I'm standing there and I've got like a straight face and I'm looking straight ahead and I'm listening to my radio traffic. I got my radio on, right? And I hear this fire go out up the road, and I'm like, oh, that's his house, the shooter's house. And his name is, by the way. He's going to burn down his house. He's going to kill himself. And I just knew it. I didn't recognize the address. I didn't know it off the top of my head. But we've all seen enough TV shows to know that that's what happens. They burn down their houses, and they kill themselves. And I was right. And it was him, and he killed himself there. And regardless of how horrific the way he perpetrated was, my second friend died at that time. And I remember feeling overwhelmed by it and I was helpless. And I remember thinking, all right, dude, you're on your own. I can't help you there. I'm going to stay with Tori. And it's just what I was thinking. Like, I knew I wasn't going to go up there and try and make that better because I couldn't. So I stood there with Tori. I'm there for probably over an hour. And finally, this big, giant deputy says, hey, you need to come out. And I'm like, I'm good. I'm not leaving him. He's my friend. He said, no, you need to come out. He says, we got it. He points, and he's got this other smaller deputy. She's like the opposite of him. He's 6'8", 300 pounds, and she's like 5'4", 120. And I look back up at him, and I just start sobbing. And he catches me, and I couldn't stop. And, I probably cried for 5 or 10 minutes. And then I finally end up sitting on this rock and I'm feeling claustrophobic and I need to leave. And we've been on scene to this call now for a couple hours because they haven't let us go yet. I see the chief. I'm like, hey, chief, we need to leave. I need to leave. I need out of here. He's like, yeah, we're working on it. I know. And they finally get us out. And and that was just the beginning. I thought the call was over then. And it was hard. I've never felt anything so hard, and I didn't even really do anything. I didn't stand there with my friend, so he wouldn't
there's
be
not a whole. There's not a whole lot you could do. Here's the thing. People talk about survivor's guilt, and I think it covers a lot of things, but it took me a very long time to get to the point where I realized I'm not God. I'm not Superman. I just did the best I could with what I had, and it's really all you can do is the best you can. But sometimes it feels so inadequate, and you can't turn back the hands of time.
No.
And that's the really frustrating part. That's the part. It's like, I'm sure, Ed, I don't know you, but I do know your story. I do know the feelings. I'm sure if you could have done anything, you would have done that. And that's the thing that really just can become overwhelming.
Right. And, probably the hardest part of this that I deal with currently, now it's been 2.5 years. There was a time, and this came out during the stress debrief, and I brought this up at our stress debrief, which was like hours later in this room full of people. Like when I say full of people, I mean 150 people were at the stress debrief. So it wasn't much of a stress debrief. It was the fire chief addressing the entire battalion and then some. there came this part in that debrief where I told the room, I'm like, you know what? They've got through all the Chiefs talking and they asked, does anybody from the call want to talk? And Jeff was frustrated. He's the other captain and he said some things he was upset about. And that got to me and I said, you know what? 2 months ago, I was working overtime with at that same fire station and Troy was leaving and they were flipping each other off. And I looked at and said, hey, man, you can be professional. You don't have to be friends and spend time with them, but you can be professional. And he looked at me and he said, Tori is nothing a bullet wouldn't fix. And I've heard guys my entire career talk bad about each other and say bad things when they're, you know, whatever, trying to over-exaggerate their points. I didn't think anything of it, but it was the first thing I thought when going through this call, and even to this day, I still don't know what to do with it. It's hard.
Well, it is hard because it's like when a lot of people say things like that, we know that it's just the emotions talking. We know that they are not going to follow through with it, but this guy did. And that's the part that's got to be paralyzing for you at times.
It's brutal. And I don't know what to do with it. And, you know, what we kind of mentioned at the beginning of your show, like how it's affected my marriage. I got super disconnected eventually. I wasn't talking. I was sitting on the couch. It took a while for me to get to that point. Now I've talked to a therapist and I still talk to my therapist and she's great. And everybody around me says I'm doing better now than I was.
Right. I'm sure you are. But deep down inside, do you feel like you're doing better or are there days where you go, oh, I don't think I can make it?
I have days where I'm just wondering how to get out of bed. And then I have other days where I feel great. It's definitely up and down.
Look, I go through the same thing because it's different causes. But here's the reality. What has helped me? And for those, I don't care whether you were a victim of crime. I don't care if you're a firefighter, you're a law enforcement, you're military, you're the surviving spouse of someone who died by suicide or whatever it might be. One of the things that helped me immensely and still does was I had to learn a degree of acceptance. It didn't mean I liked it. It means I had to accept that these things happen. And then I had to take ownership saying, okay, this is how I've been negatively impacted and affected. I'm not going to be like I was when I was 18. I'm not going to be like I was before this stuff happened. So it's up to me to do the thing so that I don't wind up bleeding, for lack of better words, all over people who are very important to me. We're talking with Ed Monroe, fire captain in Los Angeles County, California. When we return, we're going to talk about how this trauma, and it's a horrendous incident, affected his marriage, his relationships, and most importantly, what he's done afterwards. Get access to free podcast versions of the show and more on Facebook. Do a search for the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and be sure to click like. This is Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. If you're on the Clubhouse drop-in audio chat app, be sure to look for me and follow me. My name's John, the letter J, Wiley, W-I-L-E-Y. You can also search for @LET Radio Show. That's John J. Wiley, W-I-L-E-Y, @LET Radio Show on the Clubhouse drop-in audio chat app. During a conversation with Ed Monroe on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. Ed is an active duty fire captain in Los Angeles County, California, talking about a horrendous event where a firefighter shot and killed another firefighter, killed himself and shot and severely injured a third firefighter. And we're really not going into trials by media about why, what happened. We're really focusing on Ed's story. Before we went to break, Ed, one of the things you talked about was that eventually you began to withdraw. You began to isolate. My now ex-wife would say that I would go on many vacations. I would get home from work and I would just totally withdraw and not talk to anybody. And the psychologists call it disassociating. I would do whatever I could to eliminate any kind of, and I'm air quoting, triggers that would start this stuff going. Is that a fair representation of what you were going through?
Yeah, that's fair. I was completely isolating at home, and at work I would try and stay busy, but I wasn't a great guy to be around at work. I was starting to, you know, needlessly yell at my firemen, which wasn't a good thing. It was tough. And I even went through this part where, you know, I went off on stress and had EMDR, which really, really helped me. I'm a big advocate for EMDR for anybody who's wondering about that. And then I thought I was doing really well. And then what happened was, is our insurance carrier on the job, who handles all the workman's comp stuff, and I only missed six shifts of work, like 2.5 weeks. The workman's comp people, they denied my claim initially. And that 100% sent me into a tailspin. About 30 seconds, dude, when they tell you to deny your claim.
Horror stories about workers' comp. I swear they're the enemy. I say it all the time. Yeah. And by the way, they're contracted by the cities, the counties, the local governments to do their ugly bidding. And those city, county governments, they're directly responsible for workers' compensation, what they do. Directly responsible.
I would agree. But it 100% sent me to a tailspin. And to this day, I think that phone call may have damaged me more than the actual call I was on. Because in about 30 seconds, I was thinking, well, if this company who's assigned to help me doesn't believe me, then, you know, my peers don't believe me, and my crew doesn't believe me, and my family doesn't believe me. And then you start thinking, well, why am I even here if nobody believes me? And maybe it's all in my head. And it definitely took me to this really bad place, and I felt alone and isolated, and I just went downhill from there. And, you know, my wife, she kept us married through sheer force of will, and my hat is definitely off to her for that. That was not a great guy to be around.
There's a special place in heaven for people like her. And look, I tell people, I was very angry, very bitter for a long time. And I'm going to get back to something you said. But I was so angry. And the truth is that my now ex-wife did not do anything. She didn't sign up for that. I changed dramatically. And I have to take responsibility for that. But one of the things you said was the incident was bad enough, but the department or the admin or the workers' compensation insurance, how they treated you, that was more of a problem for you?
It was totally more of a problem for me. Now, it ended up getting resolved. I had to go see a qualified medical examiner for psychiatric stuff. Went through a grueling set of exams and interviews. You know, I was there for like 6 hours one day. And the doc there was very helpful. They ended up picking up my claim ultimately, but I had to jump through a whole lot of hoops on something that I felt should have been a slam dunk. And like, hey, we get it. We're not going to give you a hard time or pushback on it. And I really had to fight for it. I had to become my own advocate. I would tell anybody who's going through anything like this that you have to become your own advocate, because if you don't, there's nobody else who's going to fight this battle for you.
That's true. That is absolute truth. And one of the battles that's really important is, you and your wife, your spouse, have been married quite a while at that point, hadn't you?
Oh, yeah. We'd been married for probably 10 years by the time I became a fireman. So she knew me well before I was ever somebody cool. She knew me when I was kind of a nerd going to school. But now we've been married for 28 years, and she's still, you know, we're still together and, you know, hanging on. She's put up with a whole lot of stuff, you know, that she never signed up for.
That's
I signed up for.
When they say, well, you knew what you signed up for. Well, I say this. I thought I knew. I didn't realize how intense it was going to be, or unrelenting it was going to be. But my wife at the time and my daughters did not sign up for this at all.
No. We signed up for the chaos, so to speak. We don't sign up for this kind of chaos, but we know that getting into law enforcement or firefighting, there's a certain amount of chaos that we're signing up for. And it's because we're adrenaline junkies. We want like meaningful jobs, and we don't want to sit at a desk, and we want to do something that's unique and meaningful and have a good time doing it. But we don't sign up for this.
So did you find there were things, or what were those things that catapulted you saying, I got to get serious, I need to get help?
The isolation I was going through and how alone I felt, I knew I needed to get help. And when I started looking from the outside in at myself, when I knew I had changed, I knew I was somebody different than I had been on May 31st of 2021, because this all happened on June 1st of 2021. I knew I changed.
Reality is not a long time ago.
No.
So you're still in the early stages of dealing with this. And let's not discount all the trauma you went through before that, because I'm a big believer in that. The analogy I was given, when we graduate from the academy, you're given a backpack, a state-of-the-art backpack at the time. But every call you go to, you're going to pick up a pebble. Some of them will be big, some will be small. If you don't find a way to deal and unload some of those pebbles, one day something's going to happen, and the backpack is going to collapse, and you are going to collapse right along with it. So you went through a lot before this occurred.
Oh, yeah. You know what I tell guys when I talk to guys about this and they want to hear about this call? I tell them, you know what? You don't need a big sideways call. It can be the, you know, 4-year-old in a pool. It can be the 12-year-old who hangs himself in the closet. It can be the 55-year-old man dying in front of his family 2 days before Christmas. And then I look at him and say, those are all calls I've had.
Right.
Those are all the normal calls. You know? That's all that stuff I carry around, and I don't like talking about any of those calls, but I use them now as an example for, because I know everybody on the job has those calls.
Well, you're only one call away from a really bad thing happening. It could be physical injury, it could be mental injury, or both.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
You went through the bad stuff, and hopefully the really bad stuff is gone for you. I know it's not. But it sounds like you are on the right path for dealing with it better. A lot of that you use as motivation for what you do today to help others. Am I overshadowing that?
No, it helps me a lot. What helps me now is talking to groups of people, whether it be a crew at a fire station or even somebody one-on-one. I've gone to a sheriff station, fire station, to go to a conference, a big conference, a small conference. If I can reach one person in a group and have them feel like, hey, this guy's got to do it, I can do it, help them not feel isolated and alone, then I've succeeded. And that's what I want to do, so I can have some kind of positiveness come out of this. It helps me to deal with it knowing I can try and help somebody else do their stuff, because I know how hard it was for me. You know, it was hearing another law enforcement officer's talk, and what he went through is what helped me. So I got the idea, hey, if he did it for me, I can do it for somebody else.
Now, if people want to get in touch with you for speaking or whatever it might be, what is the easiest and best way to find you?
But the easiest and best way is on LinkedIn. I am the only Ed Monroe that works for a Los Angeles County Fire Department, especially on LinkedIn. I just did a search for myself on there today. There's only 4 of them. Ed Monroe's in the country on LinkedIn, and then I'm the only one that works for the fire department, so I'm easy to find.
And you can also go to events.brothershelpingbrothers.org and get more information. Ed, look, I want to thank you so much for your service, and secondly, I really want to thank you for exposing yourself and telling the story on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. Very much appreciated.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me here, and I hope that I've been able to help at least a couple people who hear this.
Follow the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and podcast on the Newsbreak app. It's free. And get the latest crime and law enforcement news on the Newsbreak app. It's simple, easy, and free. Just download the Newsbreak app. Then search for and follow the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and podcast on the Newsbreak app. If you want to be a guest on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show, simply contact us. It couldn't be easier. You can send us a message on Facebook. Look for and like the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show page, or email jay@letradio.com. That's jay@letradio.com. I'd like to thank our guests for coming on the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show. The Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show is a nationally syndicated weekly radio show broadcast on numerous AM and FM radio stations across the country. We're always adding more affiliate stations. If you enjoyed the podcast version of the show, which is always free, please do me a favor and tell a friend or two or three. I'll be back in just a few days with another episode of the Law Enforcement Talk Radio Show and podcast. Until then, this is John J. Wiley. See ya.